I don't want this to be heavy. I want it to be rather light and airy and have a good time. And I think marriage, when it's the right kind of relationship between husband and wife, it's just plain a lot of fun. And it's enjoyable. And I believe God meant it to be that way. When the relationship is not right, it can get a little bit stiff. And a little difficult. Sticky, like wading through molasses in January, something like that. But I know we all want the kind of relationship that God has intended for it to be. Well, let's just have a word of prayer, and we'll get on with it. Father, we thank you for these dear, wonderful gals that you've given to us. We feel very privileged because of the way you've led in our lives and prepared them for us and prepared us for them. And then in the course of your own will and at the right time, our paths in life crossed and we met, were attracted to one another, fell in love, and eventually you led us to become husband and wife. And Lord, we just express to you this morning as men who love you and who love these gals, our deep appreciation for them. We pray for them right now that as they're down there in the great hall, praying together and sharing together, that you'd give them a rich time. And Lord, show us some things this morning from a practical standpoint on this matter of our relationship with our wives and our understanding of them and loving of them. Some things that can be of real help to us, just from the practical standpoint. Give us a good time together, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. I came across an article some time ago that to me is rather humorous and yet rather pointed and rather descriptive of us as men and as husbands. And it's called How to Tell a Man from a Woman. Some lighthearted observations on the nature of he's and she's, and I'd like to read it to you. If the shoe fits, why, put it on and wear it for a while and see how it goes. What is a man? A man is a creature of superlative intelligence who can Would you guys all like copies of this? So you can let your wives read it? Okay, the next point is, a man is a creature of superlative intelligence who can understand the principle of jet propulsion, the parimutuel betting system, and the Dow Jones averages. But he can't figure out how to fold a baby's diaper. He can't understand the rules for Monopoly. And he can't grasp the basic theory of the hook and eye. I take it that some of you guys don't even know what the hook and eye is. A man. Oh. A man has a remarkably retentive memory. He can recall the score of the Army-Navy game in 1948. The electoral votes the Republicans won in the last election, and the gas mileage of his first car. But he can't remember what size socks he wears, the ages of his children, or the name of that old Richard Rogers number that his wife refers to as our song. And what is a woman? A woman is a rattle brain who can't read slide rule, who can't follow a road map, and is vague about the make and model of the car she drives. But she can recall in vivid detail the yellow organdy dress she wore to her high school prom, and she can mentally multiply 16 people by 2 1/2 cheese canopies each while she's cooking beef stroganoff, ironing a blouse, helping one child compose a letter to Santa Claus, and listening to another practice scales on the piano. That's her, brother. A man has astounding manual dexterity. He can light a match with his fingernail. He can untangle a hopelessly snarled fishing line. He can repair a light cord, fix a carburetor, operate a power saw, and park a 17-foot car in a 16-foot parking space. A woman can't do anything like that. But she can hang up a bath towel so that the monogram is right side out and precisely centered. She can unjam a stuck zipper. She can construct a pin curl and remove a sliver and balance a plate of food on her lap. A man is decisive. He can make instantaneous decisions about mergers and advertising campaigns, cutbacks in production, and million-dollar bond issues. But he has to appeal to his wife, that little muddlehead who can't decide how much to tip a bellboy, to help him decide which necktie to wear with his blue suit and what to send his mother for her birthday. Faced with a continental menu, he shrugs helplessly and asks, honey, do I like beef bourguignon? A man is stoical about thunderstorms and rattlesnakes and spiders. He is fearless about guns and one-engine planes, and he'd give his eye teeth to be an astronaut. He has tremendous physical stamina and thinks it's great fun to spend all day in a cold duck blind. A woman is a weak, timorous creature who lies awake hearing strange noises after reading a news bulletin about a psychopathic killer has escaped from prison 1,500 miles away. But she doesn't quail in terror from a new baby. She'll brave the rigors of an August white sale. And she has an adventurous attitude toward the indefinable hors d'oeuvres. When she doesn't feel well, she does a very courageous thing. She goes to a doctor. A man has quick reflexes and keenly developed eyesight and hearing. He can keep track of the ball at a football game. He can detect an engine knock that is inaudible to the feminine ear. But he can't hear a baby cry for its bottle in the middle of the night. And he can't use the telephone if a child is banging two pot lids together in the next room. A man has great presence of mind in a crisis. He is a mountain of strength in a hurricane. He keeps his head when passing a truck at 60 miles an hour. He has a calm, philosophical attitude about... Copying machine didn't do too well right there. Permanents that turn fuzzy. And ovens that go on the blink 2 hours before a dinner party. But he loses his head in a maternity ward, becomes a bundle of nerves during spring cleaning, and is inconsolable when his golf game goes bad. Men are practical, hard-headed realists, quite unlike women, who are notoriously childlike when it comes to anything concerning money. With paper, pencil, and patent logic, a man can prove the folly of transferring a savings account from one bank to another in order to get a $3.95 set of steak knives absolutely free. But a man has implicit faith in hot market tips. He can use the same paper and pencil to prove that buying a new car is cheaper in the long run than getting new tires for the old car. A man has a sixth sense that enables him to find his way through the cloverleaf, under the overpass, over the viaduct, across the bridge, and straight east to the airport without making a single wrong turn in ample time to meet the 1035 from Seattle. A woman has a sixth sense that prompts her to keep telling him, George, I have a funny feeling that we're headed in the wrong direction. How many times has that happened? But a woman can find the adhesive tape in the medicine cabinet, and she has an uncanny prophetic sense that tells her when to arrive at a dinner party. All in all, a man is absolutely indispensable. He is brilliant, resourceful, brave, strong, steady, and a rock to lean upon. But it is his utter helplessness that's his greatest asset, because it gives his wife, that little flutter brain who can't open a jar of pickles, the certain knowledge that she is indispensable. And he couldn't get along without her, as indeed he couldn't. Come to think of it, this isn't such a bad state of affairs. Well, there's some real truth in them there words, aren't there? Huh. I remember one time, years and years ago, this was within the first 4 years of our marriage, I was working with Young Life down in Dallas, and while I was in seminary, and we were at Christmas time, we were bringing a carload of kids up to Star Ranch for a ski camp. And we left about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and drove all night to get here. And we got to Amarillo in the middle of the night and everybody else was asleep but me, and I was driving and headed out of Amarillo. And Carol woke up and we were driving along, and we went along after Amarillo for about an hour or an hour and a half. And she made some comment, honey, are you sure you're going in the right direction? I said, yeah, man, see, that's the North Star up there, and we're supposed to be going north. We're headed right. And about 10 minutes later, she asked the same question again. Honey, are you sure we're going in the right direction? I said, yeah, that's the North Star up there. Then we began to see signs, Lubbock, Texas. And it suddenly dawned on me that Lubbock wasn't north of Amarillo. It was south of Amarillo. And finally we got out the road map and looked at it. And her sixth sense was right, and my map reading was wrong. She has never let me forget that North Star incident. Ephesians chapter 5. Verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are all members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. This passage is really interesting to me, particularly in light of the fact that I feel the exhortation to husbands and wives actually begins back at the end of chapter 3 with verse 32, where it says, and be kind, be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving. Someone has said that a good marriage relationship is made up of two people who are awfully good forgivers. And you know, there's a lot of truth in that. Forgiving one another. And kindness is a big part of this matter, it seems to me, of our expressing our love to our wives. But another interesting aspect of this passage is that it goes on at the beginning, the first half of chapter 5, to unfold some of the do's and don'ts of the Christian life. For instance, be therefore followers of God as dear children. Walk in love as Christ also hath loved us and hath given himself for us. Avoid fornication, uncleanness, covetousness. Verse 4, don't participate in filthiness or foolish talking or jesting. Our mouths are involved here. And this is a very important aspect of the marriage relationship, by the way, and we're going to touch on this. No whoremongering, unclean person, covetous man. These are to be put away. We're not to be any more children of disobedience as we once were. We're to be children of light, as it says in verse 8. We're to exemplify the fruits of the Spirit in verse 9. We're not to have fellowship with unfruitful works of darkness, verse 11. We're to be filled with the Spirit. We're supposed to redeem the time. All of these are practical aspects of the Christian life, which in the life of the husband and of the wife need to be adhered to. And this is the foundation upon which a good marriage is built. The individual life of the husband and the wife and their walk before God. There's the foundation, which is laid for us here in the early part of chapter 5. And then he gets in to the relationship of husband and wife, children and parents, servants and employee, and that type of thing. And the same thing is true in the child-parent relationship, and the same thing is true in the servant-employee relationship. That the foundation of it is based upon our walk and our relationship with Christ, and particular to these practical outworkings of that relationship, which are dealt with in chapter 5. But the basic and primary responsibility of us husbands toward our wives is to love them. Someone has said that love is essential to both. To be admired is essential to both. But to be loved is more important to a woman. And to be admired is vital to a man. And a wife is to reverence her husband, is to admire him, and to give him that encouragement. You guys know as well as I do that we really need that from our wives. We need to hear them say it in so many different ways and to express it. But our basic responsibility is to love them. And we are to love them as Christ loved his church. And one of the things that has always fascinated me as I've gone through the scriptures about God's love toward man is that there is always action involved with it. It is never a passive thing. It is never just something that God says. It is always accompanied with action. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. That's an action word. But God commendeth his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. My little children, let us not love in tongue or in word, but in deed and in truth, in action, and out of the abundance of a truthful heart. 1 John 3:18. That is the kind of love that Christ had for us. The expression of his love is always... He always puts shoe leather to it, and that is the way our love is to be exemplified to our wives. Now, what are some practical ways that we can do this? I don't know whether you guys have read this book by Charlie W. Shedd, Letters to Philip, or the subtitle is How to Treat a Woman. But if you haven't read this, you should get a hold of a copy, and I would recommend that you get a hardback. Because it's the kind of thing you should read through probably about once a year, at least. Just by way of reminder. I think this guy is a minister. I'm not sure that he's really... I doubt that he's an evangelical. He probably really knows the Lord. But God has given him a unique ability to write and to put things down in such a way that it really rings the bell. And he can say things so succinctly at times. So I would recommend that you get it. And he has one chapter in here. I'm going to be referring to this several times this morning, but...
what's the author's name, Dave?
Charlie W. Shedd, S-H-E-D-D. It's published by Doubleday. Do they? Yeah. Yeah, and the other, the companion volume is Letters to Karen. Philip was his son, Charlie Shedd's son, and Karen was his daughter. And it, really what it comprises is a series of letters to his son right after he got married, and a series of letters to his daughter right after she got married, and how she should treat her husband and how he should treat his wife, and his thoughts on various subjects. And it's quite interesting. He writes in the sixth letter, entitled, "If You Like It, Say So." And he starts out, he says, "Dear Phil, there are three things I aim to do every day as a husband. I aim to do every day as a husband. One, tell her I love her. Two, do something nice for her. And three, pay her a compliment." And he says in the next paragraph, "The truth is that this only sounds simple. But you try these as a regular discipline and you will see that they say easier than they do. And the toughest of these to remember may be number three, that is to pay her a compliment." And I don't know whether you guys practice this or not, but to me it is a very simple, inexpensive, effective way of expressing our love to our wives in various ways, and that is to compliment her. Find something to compliment her on each day. Of course, there are certain things that if you miss on, you just, I mean... You really better go in the bedroom and get on your knees and confess it. Like if she comes home with her hair, just having gotten her hair done, and you don't say something about it, brother. Or a new dress. Or something new that she is wearing that you happen to know about. He talks about a meal. And I don't know whether you guys have gotten into the habit of complimenting your wife on a delicious meal, but he has just a couple of short paragraphs here that say it so much better than I could. He has several little expressions that he suggests that can be used, and of course you can make up your own, such as, "Baby, your apple pie is all by itself." And then he goes on, "Do you realize, my dear boy, what a tremendous undertaking it is to serve a good meal?" And I don't know whether you guys have ever thought about that, but I have. I've watched Carol operate in that kitchen, brother. And I could never do it. I mean, how in the world she can... Especially at Thanksgiving, when, you know, we had 20 or 25 people over for dinner, and she starts 3 days ahead and puts stuff in the freezer. But then when everybody, about 2 o'clock on Thanksgiving afternoon, sits down to that meal, you know, it all comes out at the same time. It's fantastic. Planning, buying, preparing, cooking, setting the table, dishing it up, and then the whole messy business in reverse when it's over. In fact, one good meal is such an accomplishment that for you to sit there, devour it, and then hurry on back to your TV game without ever saying a good word must be a mortal sin. Of course, I'm not God, and I don't know the answer to the old argument about whether there are major and minor evils. But I've had to get up a few meals from beginning to end. And if there is a difference, then neglecting to compliment the wife on a good dinner must be a very major error. There are some instances in which you'd be a fool to pass up a 100% return on your investment. This is one of them, and just 7 words will do it. That was a great meal. Thank you. And you know, there are all kinds of opportunities like that where just a short word, the arm around the shoulder, a little kiss on the cheek, and a word of appreciation, man can pay dividends that you never dreamed of. And it only takes a couple of seconds. For instance, have you ever done this to your wife? She's in there fixing a meal. And you know, she doesn't look her best right now. Maybe she's been working at it for an hour or so and baking and so forth, and she's got flour on her cheek, and you walk into the kitchen, you survey the situation, you walk over to her and pull her away from the stove and take her into your arms and really lay one on her. I mean, a real backbender. And then just let up and notice the shocked expression on her face, and then just walk away. You know, that's an investment that'll pay off for the whole week. Huh. Or, something like, just out of the blue, honey, you're really terrific. Or if you run it, really want to get mushy, something like, Dahl, you're not a woman, you're a memorable occasion. Well, these little things really pay off, and they are just an expression to our wives that, you know, that we really do care. And it doesn't take much time. It does take a little work and forethought and, you know, a little ingenious thinking, but to develop the habit of this, to every day pay her a compliment. Every day, without fail, tell her you love her, verbally. And to try and do something nice for her. You know, on the trying to do something nice, there are so many little things we can do around the house. How many times has your wife asked you to do something? Like fix the leaky faucet or replace an electric light bulb that's burned out. And I'll take care of that, honey. And then a week later, it's the same thing. And how long does it take to replace an electric light bulb? I mean, really. Some of them are kind of complicated. It may take all of 5 minutes. You know, you got to unscrew the deal and let the thing down, and maybe a little tricky, and then you got to get the bulb and little things that she asks you to do around the house are an expression of your love because she is really concerned about that house. She wants to keep it nice for your sake. Are you fun to live with? Do you make life exciting? The other day, Lynn was, it's been several months ago now. Lynn was sitting in the living room, our daughter, reading a book from one of her classes that she was taking. It was a marriage class, and the book was entitled Building a Successful Marriage, and it contained a very thoughtful statement, and here's how it goes. One of the most important characteristics of a marriageable person is the habit of happiness. It would be impossible to overestimate the value of cultivating this trait in oneself and of seeking it in a marriage partner. The habit of happiness. And as Sandy pointed out the other day when he was talking to us, the hardest place for us to really express joy and be on top of the situation and not get grouchy and bark is in our own homes. The habit of happiness. Proverbs puts it this way in 17:22, a cheerful heart is a good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. And you know, a lot of times, boy, we had a hard day out there on the campus, it's been a rough night, and we get home, and what happens when we walk in that front door? Well, all of our trials and all of our tribulations begin to unload, and we take it out on our wife and our kids. A cheerful heart is a good medicine. Do you have a cheerful heart? Are you fun to be with at home, with your wife, when it's just the two of you? Do you really, have you really developed the habit of enjoying one another? Do you know how to spend time with your wife, just the two of you, and have a good time? Doing nothing. I'm not talking about the date now or necessarily going out for dinner. Or, I mean just sitting there in the living room after the kids are in bed or at the breakfast table, just the two of you. Guys, this takes work to develop this kind of a relationship. Carol and I have been at it now for 21 years, and it gets better all the time. But we've had to work at it. In fact, we were talking about this morning, and that we've developed some habits with each other that are really built in now. But it's still we still have to work at this matter of relating to one another and of expressing our mutual love and appreciation for each other. Guys, does it excite you to make her happy? The little things. I'm not talking about big and expensive and flamboyant type things, but are you continually working at this matter of dreaming up little ways that you know will please her? Bringing her flowers. You go on a trip, bring her a gift. Not something necessarily expensive, perfume, a little trinket, or something that's characteristic of the place you went. A bracelet, something like that. What are you aware of that she enjoys to do, but you know, you can take it or leave it, or maybe you could leave it. Like going shopping, for instance. When was the last time you initiated a little shopping trip? Said, honey, let's... You know, we've needed a new lamp there in that end table in the living room for months. How about let's go look for one? And so you take 2 or 3 hours and off you go, the two of you. Do you do things like that? When was the last time you happened to be home at lunchtime and no one else was around? And instead of her fixing hot dogs, you say, let's go out to lunch. And so you take her to a place that you know she likes. Carol has we've got a shopping center. It's one of these indoor affairs called Randhurst over near us. It's about a 15-minute drive. And in the middle of it, up on the second story, right in the middle with all the stores all the way around, there's a restaurant. It's called the Bird's Nest or the Crow's Nest or something. I don't remember exactly. But it's a feminine place to eat. I mean, you know, it's kind of petite and frilly and nice. Well, I happen to know that Carol likes to eat there, especially for lunch. So once in a while when I'm free for lunch and I'm around the house, and I'll say, let's go over to the Bird's Nest or whatever it is. Pigeon Loft, yeah. You know what a woman likes? She likes to be surprised. She really does. And boy, if you can think about something that will surprise her, it'll keep sparkle and zest in your relationship. Oh, I don't mean every day or every week, but once in a while, you know, just at the time she thinks she's really got you figured out, come up with something that's, you know, way out of left field, boy. And really throw her.
That's not like the surprise of 5 people coming in.
No, that isn't exactly the kind of thing I had in mind.
Driving up to the Cadillac.
Shed refers to these things as fragments of devotion. And I like that. It doesn't have to be big or expensive or, you know, a trip to Bermuda or something like that. Just a little thing. On our 21st anniversary, I was trying to think of something, you know, that man would... Man, 21 years, that's a long time to be married to one woman. And I was trying to think of something really fantastic to get her. And I couldn't think of anything. You know, a new suit or a sweater or something. I ended up sending her 21 red roses. And you know, I couldn't have done anything better. I really aced out on that one. I try to come home early, if I can, from a trip, and surprise her. If I can get home a day early. And then if I'm flying, why, just as I hop on the plane, I'll give her a call and say, hey, I'm going to be home tonight instead of tomorrow afternoon. Yeah.
And that last statement, you said you call her just before you get on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
What's the thinking behind that?
The surprise. And usually that's about as soon as I get to it.
It's something I just discovered about my own wife, is that she'll get excited about it then and be super ready when I get there.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of
fun. You get the picture, John. Shed has a comment on this. He says, we said before that you'd better spend some time trying to think like a woman thinks. If you do, you will discover why all these things, these little things, mean so much to her. One of the strangest bits of feminine logic going on in a woman's head is something I find hard to explain. The best way I can put it is that although she wants you to feel secure with her and she wants to feel secure with you, she still hopes that you will keep on pursuing her even after you have won her. The male intellect differs here in that we are likely to reason, well, now that's done, what's next? The female, on the other hand, doesn't think that way. With her, this is more like our family story about Bach. You remember, this young pianist had completed her first year at the conservatory. When her old professor at home asked her what they had accomplished that semester, she answered, "Thank goodness we finished Bach." Whereupon the aged sage replied, "My dear, nobody ever finishes Bach. You may turn Bach off, but you never finish him." This is how love is to a woman. The man may think when he says, "I do," that he has accomplished his mission. His wife, being much wiser about these things, senses that true love has no maximum. For those who keep opening new roads into each other's hearts each day and very often, new possibilities are forever opening up, and the greatest love goes on to new greatness. I suppose this is why I have never heard one woman complain about her husband being too considerate. I'm wondering if there is any woman anywhere who ever got too much affection. I doubt it. They're not made that way. All the good ones I know have an endless capacity for devotion and tenderness, and the little things. So, we need to work at them. And you know, guys, we do this in our ministry, don't we? We try to be creative, innovative. We try and come up with new things that will make our ministries exciting to the men we're working with, to keep them fired up and going. Well, man, if we can give that kind of devotion and attention to our ministry, why not to our wives? And it's these little things, guys, that will let her know that next to God, she is number one in your thoughts. And she needs that. She needs to know that next to God, she's number one in your thoughts. Now, let me explain that a little bit. I've talked about this with some guys, and I found out that it was rather shocking to them. But ask yourself the question, by my actions, how would my wife list these items in order of priority in my life? By my actions, how would my wife list these items in order of priority in my life? The ministry, God and my relationship to Him, the navigators, my wife, my children. How would she juggle those five things around as she observes you and watches you and what you do? What would be number one on the list, number two, and number three? The first three are probably the most important as to how she would put them. And I've talked to wives who are in the navigators, a number of them, who list them this way. God is first, obviously, in your lives. The navigators or the ministry are second, and she is third. And brethren, I commend to you that that is sin, if that is true in your life. God has given you this gal, and she, next to God, is to be number one. Now, I'm not talking about the amount of time you spend with her. I'm talking about in your thoughts. This is the key thing to a woman. That she knows that you have her up here always, and that her best interests you have at heart. By the way, you might ask your wife to do this sometime at the appropriate time, just to find out for yourself where you do stand on this and how you do come through, how she's reading you. I'm not talking about the amount of time that you spend with her or the amount of thinking time that you give to her. It's the priority that she has in your thoughts, not the amount of time. Now, let me read from you a story from Shedd that is rather a negative example of what I'm talking about. And I'm sure none of you guys would pull anything like this. It's, I'm sure you appreciate your wife more than this. Let me present to you one of the prize illustrations of why women cut their wrists and drown themselves in bathtubs. It is also why they leave notes that read, "Dear John, I have gone away with Herbert. Goodbye." Fortunately, that didn't happen here, but some women are made of very stern stuff. This one was. She came into my study looking for all the world like she had just dedicated her life to getting even. The reason she looked that way is that she had just dedicated her life to getting even. She'd been in an automobile accident 5 days before. Some women go all to pieces at times like this. Others, bless their hearts, experience a sudden rush of good judgment. So, being one of the latter and a dutiful wife, as soon as she could, she phoned her husband. Now, what should a man do first if that happens? Of course, you're right, but that's not what he did. Instead, he asked, "How much damage did it do to the car?" Well, I mean, it was practically a new Oldsmobile. Query number two was, whose fault was it? You know that we all sound unsure of ourselves part of the time, and particularly when our nerves are shattered. So, since her answers did not suit him, he gave her explicit instructions. Obviously one of those guys who thinks of all the angles except the right one. His third offering was this little gem. "Listen, darling, do not admit one thing. You phone the insurance company and I'll call a lawyer. Do you understand what I mean?" She understood. Then, to show you that even an idiot can do some things right, he added, "Just a minute and I'll give you the insurance number." "Thank you so much," she said. "Aren't there any more questions?" "No," he replied. "I think that about covers it." "Oh, does it?" she shouted. Well, just in case you're interested, I'm at the hospital with 5 broken ribs. Now, the question is, how can a man effectively say, I'm sorry, after a thing like that? Well, the answer is, he can't effectively. Of course, I suppose in his behalf, it should be noted that he knew the accident was not fatal. Dead wives do not make phone calls. But that's the type of thing that I mean. That may never happen to you, but that's the type of thing I'm talking about, where in a crisis situation or an incident comes up or an occasion arises where there is the opportunity that your wife is weighed off against the value of something else. Do you come through loud and clear, brother, that in your thoughts, she is number one? A few nevers. Never use sarcasm in kidding or in jesting around or in cutting her down. When Carol and I were first married, we got into the habit of doing this, a very bad habit. And it didn't become apparent to us until after a couple of years, and we went out to California and spent a summer. I was working in a church. I was a youth director in a church out in Pasadena, working with a man who had been the former pastor in my church back home in Peoria, Illinois, Dr. Lowry, Oscar Lowry. And he and his wife, Millie, we had the whole summer with them. And we had we spent hours and hours with them, and we had a tremendous opportunity to observe their lives. And there was one thing that we noticed that was very outstanding about them, and that was that they never, during the whole 3 months we were with them, we never, in any kind of circumstance or situation, saw either of them cut the other down in public. They never used sarcasm in kidding each other. And I don't know whether this is a habit of yours and your wife's, but I would suggest that you discuss it with each other. If it is, if it's just your habit or if it's both of you, and in most cases when it goes on, it's both parties that are involved in it. I would suggest that you discuss it, you prayerfully take it to the Lord, and ask Him to eliminate it from your lives. Because eventually, it is going to be devastating. Because little sarcastic cracks eventually become real sharp barbs, and eventually, it really becomes cutting, hurting remarks. We were with a family just recently, within the last month, where this had gotten to be a way of life with them. I mean the whole family, not only the husband and the wife, but the kids. Well, of course, it's naturally it's going to affect the kids. And we were around them for a couple of days, and boy, we were sick. How they cut one another down with sarcastic remarks. And boy, I would recommend that you never allow yourself to get into that habit, and if you have it, get rid of it. Number two. Never criticize or correct your wife in public. Example. Husband, leaving the front door. They're just walking, husband and wife are just walking out the front door of a friend who has invited them over for the evening. The husband turns and he says, "Thanks for inviting us over. This is such a welcome change from TV dinners." Husband. You better tell me, Jeannie could get lost with a police escort. Little thing, but oh, the implications of it on your wife. Now, obviously, husbands and wives are different, and we're going to be talking about some differences in just a few minutes, but Carol and I are quite different, and we've discussed some of these differences, and we try to make them complement each other. I'm rather quiet and reserved, and Carol is vivacious and outgoing. And it was interesting. One time we had a couple come through, and they stayed overnight with us, and the gals were off talking somewhere, and this guy got to talking to me, and he had noticed this about Carol and me, and he and his wife were very similar. She was kind of the effervescent, outgoing type, and he was rather quiet and reserved. And And he says, how do you handle this problem? I said, what problem? I mean, he was on the wrong foot already. He looked upon it as a problem. I look upon it as an asset. You know, there's one thing that I have a hard time doing, and that is carrying on small talk. And, you know, you get around two or three couples, and there isn't the rapport that maybe some of us would have with each other. There are very few avenues of real interest. And so, you know, you stay right on the surface. It just kills me to do that. Well, Carol can do it with a flair. I mean, man, she just wheels into a situation like that, you know. So I just let her take over. Man, she's good at it. She's gifted, and she's got the spark. And so there are many situations like that where rather than it looking upon it as a problem, man, it's a tremendous asset. Well, we all will come across or already have come across differences between us and our wives. And we need to take advantage of them and make those things assets rather than liabilities. One thing that is different than in Carol and I is that I never exaggerate. And she has a tendency to exaggerate. That was meant to be humorous. But I kid her about being the daughter of a writer, and of course she is, and we have some fun with that. I really work at never correcting her in public. She'll be telling a story, and you know there'll be some percentages involved or some figures involved. And very seldom is it right. I mean, you know, if it's supposed to be 20%, it usually ends up being 40%. Or, you know, if it's 225 people accepted Christ, why, if that's the real figure, then, you know, it may end up being 500, evangelistically speaking. There were 978 people at the Wing Ding, and she may say a little over 1,000 when it was just a little under 1,000. Well, so what? I mean, so what? Is it really worth it to stop her in the midst of something that she is relating to someone else and say, well, honey, now, it was really just under 1,000 rather than just over 1,000. I mean, what have I accomplished? Well, I can tell you what I've accomplished. And it isn't good. Now, it may be that later on, after it's over and the two of you are together, and you know this is something that she's going to be repeating over and over again, if there is, I mean, if it's a wide margin, like, you know, it's just over 2,000, why, you might want to just put a bug in her ear or something like that. But boy, never in public. Never in public. Shed has a little deal here. He says, this is something that we as husbands should solemnly swear. Solemnly swear. Put our hand on the Bible, solemnly swear. Neither by day or by night will I ever cut you down in company. Not before my family, your family, our family, not before friends, acquaintances, strangers. When you are with me or behind your back, never by wisecrack or snide remark, or in any manner do I intend to be anything other than 100% loyal. Good, solemnly swear. Number three, never compare her unfavorably with other women. Any woman, including your mother. Well, honey, you know, my mom used to fix apple dumplings, and such, man, they were terrific. I wonder if, you know, those things we had last night for supper, Mom's got a terrific recipe for that. Cooking, her own looks, the way she keeps the house, the way she entertains, her clothes, her hairstyle. If you don't like it, figure out a way to tell her. But don't do it by comparing her with some other woman. That's not the right approach. All right, number four. Never drop a delayed time bomb. One night, several weeks ago, we were going out to dinner. Well, this is not, it's been more than that. It's probably been several months ago now, but we're going out to dinner one night, and late afternoon, Carol had changed clothes. And about a half hour before we were supposed to leave, I was ready to go sit in the living room reading or something. And she walked through, and I just happened to look up, and I said, honey, you are going to change, aren't you, before we go out? The problem was that she had a dress on that I didn't like. But to complicate the problem was she'd had that dress for 2 years, and I'd never said anything about it before. That's what I mean by a delayed time bomb. Because immediately in her mind, she realized that when I said, you are going to change, I mean, man, she can read between the lines on that one. That isn't even a good coded message. She knew that I didn't like the dress. But she also took the next step and said, well, in her mind, she said, I wonder what else I have there in the closet that he doesn't like. So then she goes to her closet and looks at all those things, and she's got to pick another one now. And maybe she'll strike out again. So the time to say something like that is at the time that it is purchased or when you first see it. Otherwise, brother, keep your mouth shut from then until eternity. Five, never be late without phoning. Unless it's, you know, an impossible situation. But she happens to know that it only costs a dime to get on a payphone and call her if you're in town. In most cases, that's the kind of thing it'll be. But to a wife, late is a four-letter word. So never do that. Overlooking little things. When Carol and I were going together, we had quite a stormy courtship during our days at Wheaton. And we had the opportunity to spend a lot of time together, more time than we really should have for our own best interests. And eventually we began to pick at one another. Little things. Things I didn't like about her and things she didn't like about me. And it really got to be a problem. And we realized it, but we didn't know what to do about it. And we went in to talk to the Dean of Men, who was a very dear friend of ours and a very godly saint. And we knew that he and his wife had a wonderful relationship with each other. And so we went in one time to talk to Dr. Brooks, and in the process of chatting with him, we brought this up. And he pointed something out to me that that applied to both of us, but primarily to me because it was from his standpoint, that I have never forgotten, and I found it has stood me in good stead all down through the years of our marriage. And that is, he says, Jack, if I let the little things that bother me about my wife stay in my mind and I harbored them and let them build up, he says, we would have split up years ago. But he says, I take them to the Lord if I need to, or I just forget them. I just overlook them. And you know, it's the little foxes, guys. It's the little things. When you trace back in a marriage that has gone on the rocks, it hasn't been usually a big, explosive type of thing that happens. That may be the culmination of it all. But actually what has happened, it's been little tiny things that have eaten away at the husband or the wife or both of them, that they've harbored in their hearts, that they've never gotten either rid of and just forgotten about them, or they haven't gotten them out to one another, that has eventually caused it to come apart at the seams. And I've just developed the habit of, and I could tell you things even this week since we've been here, little things that Carol's done that have bugged me. But they're about that significant as far as the total picture of her personality and our relationship are concerned, and so I just forget them. That's her, and I love her. Now, there are some things that can be changed, and I'm not overlooking that fact, in both her and you. And these need to be talked about. But let's not nitpick. That's the thing I'm getting at. And this is where that saying that I mentioned at the outset, that someone has said that a good marriage was simply a union of two people who were awful good forgivers. Well, it's 12:25, and we're through the first point. I've got three more to go. Well, I guess we'll just keep pressing, huh? Want to stand up a minute? How are we doing?
Oh, fine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can stay. Yeah, stay. I can tell them to go ahead. Well, this is the way I go, by the way. You do whatever you feel you want to do.
Yeah, I'm good.
Go ahead.
But I can't.
Okay, let's have a seat. We'll press. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Maybe Friday afternoon. Communications between husband and wife is felt by many to be the greatest single area of difficulty and one of the greatest causes of marital breakup, even more so than the sex relationship. Now, most of the things that we have just been talking about, these little ways of expressing our love to our wives, if we develop these habits and begin to really work at these things, they create an atmosphere and a groundwork and a basis for good communications. And I am convinced that for good communications between husband and wife to take place, there has to be an atmosphere for it. And that atmosphere has to be permeated with them knowing that we love them and this being expressed in various ways, day after day after day. So the atmosphere, I feel, is of vital importance. Now, let me give you a couple of illustrations on this matter of communications. A minister had to go to a nearby city to conduct a funeral. He asked his wife to go along with him. Her reply was, "If you want me to, I'll go." "Well," the man said after a moment of silence, I'll go alone." What happened? Each had been needlessly disappointed. The husband wanted his wife with him and hoped she would offer to accompany him. Now, guys, when a man says something, when you say something to your wife, you mean it. 99% of the time, you mean exactly what you said. This gal didn't believe that her husband meant it when he said, "Would you like to go over to the city with me to the funeral?" She wanted to go, but not sure he really meant the invitation, tossed the decision back to him. He assumed she was turning him down. She assumed he didn't need her support. And so a couple who wanted to express their mutual love and need wound up feeling each had been rejected by the other. And boy, how often that happens. In so, you know, just in a moment of time. Now, two things that we can learn from this illustration. The wife didn't know the differences between a man and a woman. The man says what he means. There was no hidden, coded message in his asking her to go with him. He wouldn't have asked her if he hadn't wanted her to go. She looked for a hidden meaning when there wasn't one. Why? Because she's a woman, and women speak with hidden meanings. They speak with coded messages. We're going to get to that in a minute. And she, being a female, expected him to be like her. So, that's what she did. Her return or comeback to him, "if you want me to go," was a coded message saying, "yes, I really do want to go with you." But he failed to pick that up. Now, let me give you another illustration. A few weeks ago, I was sitting in the living room again. Carol was sitting in the living room. And all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I guess, she said, "Honey, imagine that. Everyone in our household has plans for this evening, and it's just the two of us for supper tonight." Well, it's true. That doesn't happen very often at our house. Well, now, brother, I've lived with this gal for 21 years, and that was a coded message. And I could have said, "Well, isn't that nice? We can just sit here and have dinner, the two of us. Isn't that be great?" Huh. And blown the war. Well, I didn't. Thankfully, I didn't. I said, "Well, I suppose that means you'd like to go out for dinner, huh?" Smiled when I said it. She says, she chuckled and she says, "Yep, sure does." So, we did. Now, guys, that type of a message comes across probably at least once a day from your wife about all myriads of types of things. And one of our jobs as husbands is to decode them and learn how to read them. What does she really mean by what she said? And if we don't, we're going to open our mouths many times just long enough to change feet. And we're going to miss some terrific opportunities that our wives present to us, but they're in vague tones. They're not crystal clear. Let me read you a statement that Dr. Brandt, the Christian psychiatrist, makes regarding communications between husbands and wives. He says, "If you want to appreciate and to have your feelings and desires count with your mate, then make a conscious, continuous effort to appreciate your mate and give due regard to her feelings and desires. When you and your partner approach each other with the desire to know, to listen, and to understand, you are ready to build a strong bridge across which two-way communication can flow." Now that means really opening up with each other. That's not, you don't do that by just talking on surface issues. You do that by really sharing hearts with each other. The way to maintain mutual trust in a marriage is to be frank. Both the husband and the wife have the right to know each other's mind about each other. In fact, about everything that concerns the relationship. And things that don't necessarily have to do with the relationship, but just things that are on our hearts. Carol and I had a good time this morning just sitting up there and talking about the conference and how I felt and my reactions. And she encouraged me. Because I was kind of down. She's a tremendous source of encouragement. Such an attitude puts a high premium on communication. The term is used in preference to talking. For people can do much talking and still live in a state of almost complete mental isolation. Communication means to overcome the desire to conceal feelings and thoughts and rise to the level of honesty about money, fears, wishes, motivations, sex feelings and responses, mistakes made, resentments and misunderstandings. To the level of honesty. In seeking to build a wholesome marriage, there is a high premium on making a conscious effort to express your appreciation for each other. Praise, if you will. Now, one thing that I really work at in this area is that when I am with Carol, I mean just with Carol or with Lynn, for that matter, because the same thing works with our kids, I find that works with our wives. When I am with them, I try to be all with them. I'm not just halfway. I don't have half my mind on what they're trying to say and trying to pick up snatches of what they're saying and then off here in the ministry someplace and trying to resolve a problem that I've got unless I want to bring them into that and discuss it with them. When I sit down and talk to Lynn, I listen to her, brother. She's got something to say and it's important and I want to know what it is. And I ask her questions that are halfway intelligent. So when we're with our wives, let's be with them. And when I know that there are times when that's hard. It's hard because we do have problems. We are absorbed in something and we got something on our minds and here we find ourselves, we're alone with our wives. Well, what a tremendous opportunity to share with them. A deep longing, a burden. A problem. And you know, I find my greatest counselor, my best counselor, is Carol. She sees things from a completely different perspective than I do. She reads people differently than I do, and so often her insights are far more penetrating than mine. And I feel that if we fail to use our wives as a counselor and not that I feel I have to take her advice all the time, because a woman does see things from a subjective point of view, whereas a man is more objective, and sometimes Carol will make some observations that may have some validity, and sometimes because of her subjectivity they don't. But I find that more cases she's helpful than she's not, I'll tell you that. And it gives me the opportunity to share my heart with her. Let her know what's on my thinking and some of the things that I'm facing. Another thing on communications that we found very helpful is just to work out little understandings in areas that could get sticky. And that can cause repeated problems. For instance, when I get home from a trip, I'm shot usually. And I know some of you guys are in the same boat. Well, here I have been out there, hacking around in the ministry and doing this and that and the other things. And where's she been? Well, she's been home. She's been in those four walls of that house for the last week or two. So what does she want the minute I walk in the front door? She wants to get out of the house. And also, another thing she wants is she wants to hear all about my trip. Well, if there's anything I don't feel like doing right that day or that night is, number one, I don't feel like going out for dinner. And number two, I don't feel like talking about the trip. I want to forget it for right now for a few hours and just relax, kind of collapse and come unglued. So Carol and I worked out a little understanding with each other. When I get home from a trip, we don't go out for dinner that night. Either the next night or the following night. And she doesn't ask me to tell her about the trip unless I want to talk about it. I mean, we just have that understanding with each other. You know, it resolves all kinds of little problems. But I have the agreement that the next day, I dump the truck. and tell her all about everything that happened, went on. But see, if we didn't have that, if we didn't have that understanding, every time I get home, there'd be tension. And there are numerous areas like that in our lives where if we just have a mutual understanding and agreement with each other that is mutually agreed upon, man, it solves. It's kind of like why you have policies. Policies in the Navigator organization are primarily designed to cover areas and situations that come up again and again and again. And so finally it comes up so often that, well, we just establish a policy and this is what we're going to do when this happens every time. So that's kind of the thing you're doing. You're establishing a policy with one another. We have another little understanding that Carol is asked to speak. We discuss the timing on all of her speaking engagements so that our schedules will mesh. Because, boy, when I get home, I want her to be there. I don't want to get home that night late in the afternoon and find out she's got a speaking engagement that night. Nor does she want that. So we discuss these things and work out our mutual schedules together. Another thing that we have found that works beautifully and solves a lot of problems, and that is that she invites her mother to visit us when I'm on a trip. Now, I love her mom. Great. We have a mutual... We find it works better. No, I mean that seriously. We get along great. But her dad is dead and her mom's a widow. And, you know, when she comes down, it's not just for a day or two. She'll invite her for a week and she can do it on a week that I'm gone. And she can stay for the whole week, enjoy the fellowship, and maybe your mom will, you know, come in on the first day that before I leave, or be there the day I get back, and I'll have a little time with her. But it just works out beautifully. So just little understandings that can help resolve sticky situations that if you didn't do something about it, it would come up again and again and again. You have to deal with it every time. Here's another never that I just shoved in here, but it has to do with communications, and that is never let the sun go down on your wrath. Now, for those of you guys who have just gotten married, you probably haven't faced this thing yet, but sooner or later you will. One of the first times I can remember it happening was when we were living up in Portland, although I'm sure it happened many times before that. But, you know, I came home at night after work, and I walked in the house, and Carol was out in the kitchen fixing supper, and I said, "Hi, honey." "Hello." "And have a good day." "Yes." We'd been around one another for quite a while by this time, and I read the tone of voice wasn't exactly what I'd anticipated, and so I knew there was probably something wrong, and so I walked down to the kitchen. I said, "Anything wrong, honey?" "No." Well, I mean, after a while, you guys will get to read things like that. I'm talking primarily to you newly married fellas now. And I knew that, I mean, she wasn't exactly lying, but that wasn't the truth. There was something wrong. And I resolved that one in a different way. But from time to time, it seems like that type of thing sometimes will drag on right up until bedtime. And you can't quite put your finger on it. You can't get at it. And it's still there. And man, you know, it doesn't bother me. I mean, frankly, I could roll over and go to sleep, you know, no problem with me. But you know what she's doing? She's laying there on the other side of the bed, still stewing, boy. I mean, the old wheels are still going. So there have been a number of occasions. I'm very thankful that this type of thing happens less and less now, and I think the Lord is teaching us some things, but occasionally it comes up. But I've learned that no matter what it takes, even if it's 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, to get it talked out. And boy, I am so punchy. You know, I'm sitting there trying to, you know, keep my wits about me and not say the wrong thing. And
Jack, yeah. How do you pull stuff like that out when you know they're going through?
Talk to them, boy. Ask them questions. Get them to express it. Get it out.
Sometimes I've blown it by not doing that, and I've really increased the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And one time she said, I'm not concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not concerned enough to draw on her.
That's right.
Because she did me a no. A couple times I'll ask her, but I have to work at it.
Oh, you bet. They are very reluctant sometimes to tell you what is wrong, but there is something wrong. And boy, if you don't take the time and the trouble to find out what it is, they only read that one way, and that is you don't care. It's like the cartoon. The guy's sitting here in the living room, and he's reading the paper. And his wife is telling him all about this great problem that's going to lead him to divorce if they don't do something about it. And his answer is, do we have to save our marriage while I'm reading the sports page? Well, yes. So, the best way for a husband, of course, to clinch an argument with his wife is to take her in his arms. And at the right moment, that never fails. But the timing has to be right. You've got to get your timing right on that. If you're a little premature, you're liable to be put in your arms around a stone pillar. Well, Shedd has some things to say in a chapter on communications that I would suggest, if you get the book, that you read it. He's got 7 or 8 ideas on good communications, and I won't go into them here, but you can get it and read it. He's got 7, yeah. 7 goals for communication, and they're goals, things that they strive for in their marriage relationship. All of them, of course, can never be continually attained, but at least they're goals to shoot for, and they're very good, thought-provoking, and something that you and your wife could work on. Well, it's time for lunch, and we better quit.